Contemporary Music Centre podcast series, Composer of the Month for December 2008, John Wolfe Brennan. In this interview, John talks to Michael Quinn about being an Irish composer in Switzerland, his compositional methods, research into Helvetian and Celtic cultures, jazz influences, being a performer, a composer and a teacher, composing for unusual instruments such as the pipa, and his other educational and compositional projects.
John, I wanted to start with a very basic question, but also a fundamental one. Why do you compose?
I guess every time I start a new piece, that's the basic question at the very beginning of the work. And, you know, there's this cliche that you start with a white blank piece of paper, but it's true. And I must confess that I go through hell at the beginning of every piece, because it's like, you know, a mountaineer standing in front of Himalaya or huge mountains, asking himself, well, am I prepared for this? Am I fit enough? Will I have the endurance to go through this whole process from the beginning to the very end? Do I have a clear image of what's going on inside my head? For example,
what do you know about the piece when you start? Do you know the end?
I usually know more about the end. I start with sketches, and I have a pretty shady, vague idea of, as the Italians say, dramaturgia. This is impossible to translate, I find, but the dramatic line of the whole piece. I know if it's going to, how it's going to feel more than its actual shape. You know, in trying to answer these questions, every time I answer one question, a new one comes up. I try to follow my instincts probably more than mathematical structures, which of course are always somehow lurking in the back of my mind. I can't help that, because music and mathematics are, you know, many ways the same. But I try to free myself of all these rucksacks that we have from university and maybe from composers we love or we felt influenced by when we were young. I think you're trying to avoid thinking at this point.
So this is a kind of sculptural notion, yeah, that you're whittling away to find a shape within.
I think, like sculptors sometimes say, that the figure is already there. Mm. You just have to find it, rediscovering something or discovering something. And I think the compositional process is very similar to that, in that the music doesn't need a composer to be there. The music has been there, you know, maybe for I don't know how long. So I try to rediscover what was there and will be there long when I'm gone, you know, for a long time.
Now, you're very active as a performer as well, aren't you? How does that inform how you behave as a composer? If you weren't a performer, would you be a different kind of composer, do you think?
Yeah. I think, ideally now, the two professions, which are actually one, they help each other. Because as a composer, I can learn a lot from any composer, any performer around the world. And of course, also the performer can learn from a composer. You know, the favorite example is that, for example, it happened in my second opera, which was first performed last year. I wrote really a very challenging part for timpani. So I went to, of course, see the timpani player before I started, and you know, he showed me all his tricks and with the pedals and everything. And so I went home and I said, okay, so he knows a lot about his instruments, but there's things he can't know because I don't know. So I want to find out. So what happened was a kind of a ping pong game. I came to his rehearsal room with sketches of a new part, and he looked at it and said, this is impossible. And I said, why? I said, because you can't, you know, move your foot from here, and then in the time required, you can't move it from here, if I put my foot here and I just move this around a little bit, you have five timpanis, you know, maybe we can do it, you know. So that was really great. So it's like you as a composer ask for the impossible, which is not really impossible, but maybe it looks like it's impossible for the moment. And the performer tells you, well, that doesn't work, or it's written too complicated, you know, triplets over triplets over triplets, and so on. Why don't you just write, you know, whatever? So as a composer, again, I'm open to these suggestions. And as a performer myself, I know that sometimes you can radically change notation and make things easier or even more complicated in order to get it right, you know.
You were born in Ireland and moved to Switzerland at the age of seven.
Yeah.
Does jazz, and you've just been talking about jazz as this kind of thing, this thing with a very definite sense of its own roots and its own heritage, and yet it's rootless, it's geographically rootless in many ways, but is that part of the appeal for you? Did you find something within that you...
Absolutely.
That the dislocation of being...
Yeah. I think only recently I became aware of the fact that probably, you know, going back to the very first question you asked, why do you compose, is that I really felt and still feel quite homeless where I am. And I guess music is the strongest... And most intense way of trying to create a home. So I became really aware of, you know, traditions in the plural form, not only in jazz music, also in folk music and classical music, when I was away from all that and as far away as you could possibly get, you know, really experimenting with the very... avant-garde elements of music that only consisted of noise or whatever you want to consider as noise, and on the verge of total silence.
Feel where they're, you know, in one place they're considered to be, in Switzerland you might be considered to be Irish, but in Ireland you're considered to be Swiss. So.
Yeah, well, okay. In Switzerland, which is, you mustn't forget, on the crossroads of, you know, at least four very, very strong cultural traditions, the Italian, the French, the German, and the Austrian, which Austrian is not the same as German.
We're hearing all of those in your vowel sounds.
Yeah. You have to come to grips with these traditions. At the same time, there is, I guess, you know, at least in the eyes of an Irishman, there is something like a Swiss identity, you know, and it goes deeper than cowbells and chocolate and cheese. If you go and visit the country, you'll find out, well, you know, lots of different people live in this country, in a very small country, actually. And it's the same with coming back to Ireland. You know, every time I come back, of course, it has changed and it opens up. And at the same time, you know, it's even the smell when you go out in the countryside is, you could tell from, you know, 100 different smells in the world. So there is identity and there's diversity going on at the same time. And I guess that's adds to what you said about the fragmented perception of nowadays life. We can't help it. We have no choice. We live in this fragmented world, and in a way we all have to create our own home, as it were.
And I suppose that helps or accelerates the desire to pursue the adventurousness of the avant-garde, or at least that in a way kind of provides balm for that sense of...
Very often, actually, I'm, you know, when people find out I'm from Ireland, they ask me about Irish literature. And one of the things which I found, one of the keys, when people ask, well, how is it possible such a tiny country actually has produced giants like James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, and, you know, used the metaphor of a, not the melting pot, but a kind of a cooking pot on which the lid is the Catholic Church. And that artists like Joyce, like Beckett, they had no choice. They were forced to fight against something. Now, if you grow up in a surrounding where nothing matters, you know, the famous anything goes that is attached to the postmodernist philosophy, if you can call it a philosophy, then there's nothing to fight against. So, yes, I think striving for, you know, if you're on the verge of two continental shells, as it were, you're really striving for the avant-garde, and the avant-garde is a kind of survival kit, because you want to move on and you want to keep the energy flowing, you know, so you need some reassurance in the future. You think up a word, and maybe the word just consists of one little piece, and you take consolation in the fact that, you know, you were able maybe to achieve to build this tiny little word just for the moment, for 5 seconds or 5 minutes and 35 seconds or 4 minutes and 11 seconds, and in this word now, the avant-garde, it might, relative to the continental shelf, it might seem like the avant-garde, you know, like Moorish Island of Connemara. But at the same time, there is a connection. Maybe the connection is underneath the surface. And that's, of course, you know, brings me to another's, I guess, very strong motivation. That is to try and hunt for hidden links between different cultures, like the Celtic and the Helvetian culture.
But that's obviously deep concern you have for discovering, finding alternative histories, seems to find expression in your music. I mean, Richard Cochran, a musicologist, has written that your Brennan's subject is something like the construction of an alternative Irish music. Do you recognise what he means by that?
I must confess, when I think he wrote that 8 or 9 years ago, and when I first read it, I just ignored it. I didn't, you know, I didn't really know what he meant. But over the last 2 or 3 years, and I'm thinking that I'm beginning to understand what he meant by saying this. What I like is the word construction, because I was always convinced that music is handicraft, art, and skill and science all in one. Contrary to, you know, the idea that music is something totally coming, spring from cloud 17 down to earth or whatever, and an angel kisses you and you're inspired all of a sudden. I think it has a lot to do with construction, with finding these different elements.
Do you write every piece in the same way? Does there have to be a trigger for the piece?
The trigger always comes from the piece. There's of course, when I began to compose, I also studied and adapted mechanisms like serialism or dodecaphonic theories and so on. But after a while, I became bored about the result of that in my own music. So I decided to go radically new, which is a radically old approach, and that is to always start with a blank piece of paper and not to be afraid of, you know, of this blackness of the paper. And, you know, if it's there for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, so it be, you know.
But do you have to be methodical about this? Do you have to set time aside or set yourself aside from everything?
I need the pressure, like most of us. Right. I need the pressure, and it was a huge consolation for me when I was working with people like Ennio Morricone or Hans Holliger, the oboe player and composer, or Klaus Huber, that when I was doing master classes with them, you know, that every day he got faxes, you know, loads of faxes. Mr. Huber, we absolutely need your composition, you know, the premiere is next week, and where is the piece? And he would just smile and say, it's up here. Well, you know, as a child, of course, doing all those stupid little exercises, you know, like you could probably describe it as Czerny with false notes, you know.
Because your family background is musical. Your mother was a singer.
Yeah,
and your
father was a very good amateur pianist.
And one of your uncles is a very noted Swedish composer.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, of course, I couldn't help. I was, you know, playing under the piano, under the grand piano, when my father was playing and mother was singing. My mother would sing the whole repertoire of romantic, the clavier leads, you know, Schubert, Schumann, Brahms, Hugo Wolf, Richard Strauss, and then throw in the some Irish folk songs and the mawkish arrangements of the time.
That might have prompted you to be a pianist
Well, it did and did not at the same time. I remember I started to play the piano when I was like maybe 9, and then I discovered rock music when I was maybe 12 or 13. So I found, you know, Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones and so much more exciting. So I taught myself to play the guitar, and actually played bass guitar in a rock group for many years. But that was, you know, I tended to hide that from my parents. At the same time, I went to piano lessons. And when it was like 14 or 15, my Hungarian piano teacher taught me some Bartok. And when I discovered, you know, pieces like Allegro Barbaro, I was, the two words came together, because this very intense hammering of the piano, you know, I really loved that. And for me, Bartok was like rock and piano. So I was kind of she lured me, as it were, with Bartok. And then she said, well, okay, you're allowed to play Bartok if you play, you know, Beethoven Sonata. And so I kind of found myself going back to the classical education, and I did more or less a normal classical study, like, you know, you were supposed to do. And I didn't say a word to my teachers and not to the director of the conservatory about my, you know, career as a bass player in a rock group and afterwards a pianist in the jazz group. So the two worlds were quite separate, and just came together in Bartok and some other links. But the links I discovered actually only afterwards.
But it was at college that you started to compose for theatre pieces?
Yeah. Which that was when I studied in Fribourg, in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. And I was desperate making a bit of money. And I was working, you know, like probably everybody does, you know, doing this and this little job. But then I found out that actually writing music for theatre is a very good thing for three reasons. You can make a bit of money, you have to work very fast, and you have absolutely impossible combinations of instruments. You might have, you know, the director of the theatre piece might tell you, well, we have one actor who can sing, but he has only a very, you know, low range, whatever. Then we have one actor who plays the baritone saxophone, but, you know, it's broken and only about five keys are working and so on. Then we have a percussionist, but he has a broken leg, and, you know, so you have all these things. And oh, please, would you have everything finished next week?
Now, most people think that's not a creative thing to do, but it's you're finding solutions to problems.
Yeah.
But the creativity and in doing all that and making it palatable to the ear is presumably one of the things that you were learning at the time.
Yes, and, you know, in comes improvisation, because of course you have to improvise also as a composer, you know. It felt, apart from, you know, there is the academy, the academic background, which is important. You have to learn to work fast and efficient and get your ideas across as clear as possible, because, you know, you have to face it when you write music for a theatre play. The music always comes in twice, in the second. It's not, it's, you know, a play by Bertolt Brecht, for example. It's, and the music comes in afterwards.
Subservient.
Unless you manage to do something like Three Penny Opera, you know, where the music actually transcends.
But you did actually manage to broaden that secondary role out to a kind of primary role.
Yeah.
And then you began to work with dance.
Yeah.
I was with visual artists,
yeah.
Sound
installations. Yeah.
So presumably you enjoy the kind of the physicality of, or you enjoy music that responds to physicality.
That's true.
As well
as and looking back, I also, I think there is a tremendous energy from the obstacle, you know, coming from the obstacle. It's like you have to overcome lots of obstacles when you do that. It's not a cozy thing, like when you're studying with a master and then you get a whole orchestra and you can write for that. You know, it's not this kind of alley. It's really, it's a more more challenging and also more difficult road to go down. But I found when I was like, I'd say 30 or 31, I think I must have written like music for about 50 plays. So it was a huge output. Of course, a lot of it was, you know, kind of throwaway music, like Hindemith would call Gebrauchsmusik, music just to use and to throw out. But I learned a lot from that. You know, going back to the question of performer and composer, there's a third profession inside, you know, a musician. Many musicians also teach. And I teach children from the age of I'd say 6, 7 up to my oldest pupil is 78 now. I very much like to pass on, first of all, what the little bit I know about music to the next generation. But at the same time, I think there is a whole universe to be learned by whoever teaches. If a teacher is not a student himself, he's a very bad teacher very soon. So Wurzelklänge is actually a lifelong project, going back to the question, what of my... Well, actually, several questions. One question is, where are my roots? How can I find them? How can I dig them out? How can I grow, let them grow in the present and in the future? And how can I have my kids, my students, my pupils participate in this process, process of growing? I started to collect Celtic country dances ever since I was, you know, a kid. I set some of these dances to music. I wrote a lot of new material based or inspired by these country dances. I put it aside for many years. I went back to these roots again, and now I really am determined to write a whole cycle of books for various instruments, for violin, for harp, for clarinet, for flute, for recorder, and different ensembles, and of course the piano. Touch wood that the series of Wurzelklänge will be published from next year on, and the whole series, not just one book, but you know, the whole series.
You mentioned well-prepared piano, well-prepared clavier, which is a solo project, solo piano project, and part of a trilogy of trilogies. With obviously there's a the title is a deliberate choice, a deliberate allusion. But just tell me a little bit about the project. I know it's kind of scheduled to end in 2011, but when did it begin?
I remember being a pianist. I really enjoyed to accompany singers and other instrumentalists because I was able to, you know, add my colors, as it were, from the background. And when I was, and at the same time, I was aware, of course, of the fact that the piano can very well be in the center of a whole cycle of, or, you know, be a very powerful solo instrument. Mm. But I was afraid. I was scared shitless. So when I was like going to America for the first time, I studied with really great players in the jazz world, like Carla Bley, Pat Metheny, Dave Holland, Don Cherry, and so on, at the Creative Music Studio in upstate New York in Woodstock. I remember sitting together with James Galway one night after a concert, 2 o'clock in the morning, sitting in the kitchen, and I mentioned to him, well, I'd like to go to New York because I just have this urge, and I kind of got a call from Carla Bley to really do my thing, as the Americans say, and do it. But I have a feeling that being here in Switzerland, in Europe, I would never, you know, really do it. I'd just be afraid. So would you know, would you happen to know somebody in New York, maybe with some flats? And he said, sure, you know, Jimmy Galway is like, great guess. So he called a friend, an ex-friend of his fourth wife, Jeannie. He's still married to Jeannie. Vincent Hammond, who happened to be a pianist, a classical pianist, who went to Aspen, Colorado for 6 months. So his flat was free for 6 months. So I was able to go to New York in 88. And there I wrote the first, you know, cycle of piece called The Beauty of Fractals. And The Beauty of Fractals was a huge success. It really, it gave me the feeling to give myself a kick in the ass, you know, really myself. Mm-hmm. But actually it was the city of New York that really tells you, well, you want to sell hot dogs? Fine. You don't want to sell hot dogs? Also fine. You know, you want to do a solo album? Fine, you know, but just do it. This kind of very clear and uninhibited way of attacking or approaching music.
It sounds as if the journey you've made as a composer is to move away from feeling the weight of the tradition, of certainly a classical tradition on your shoulders, and the long shadow that casts.
Very important.
Makes my metaphors now, but and now to begin to engage with it and challenge it and provoke it from within its own context, rather than just pursue other ideas in other directions. And I suppose that informs your relatively recent forays into opera, the first in 2004, the second in 2007.
Yeah. But I felt this urge to write for the grand form. I felt that many, many years ago. And in fact, its roots, again, are in the theatre music I composed, you know, when I was still a student. Mm. It's a prolongation of actually these elements that were there right from the beginning. But instead of just writing for, you know, the actor who can't sing and the baritone saxophone with one leg and so, it was, you know, for a full-scale opera.
By contrast, there's another piece that you're working on, which is also based on a piece of literature, the Divine Comedy, that's a kind of secondary stimulus. There's also the paintings of the Irish painter, whose name I now can't remember.
Samuel Walsh.
Samuel Walsh.
Yeah.
Why that's presumably you need a different approach to that text because it's diffracted through those paintings.
Actually, I think it's funny, but I just right now I think that somewhere inside there's a very strong hidden link between Auden and Walsh's interpretation of the Divine Comedy. Maybe it's the sardonic humor, maybe it's the love for the medieval times, because let's not forget that the subtitle of The Age of Anxiety is A Baroque Eclogue. Now, what on earth is an eclogue, you know? And so it's a shepherd's poem, actually. But a shepherd's poem, The Age of Anxiety, you know, it's like, help, help, you know? But this is exactly what I find so fascinating. You know, Auden is a highly literate man. He could recite the whole of Shakespeare just by heart. And I think he used a very, very ancient form of rhyming, alliterations, and a medieval form of poetry for a very, very contemporary and pressing subject.
A huge contrast again. Was this another elective affinity with Yang Ying, the Chinese pipa player, that you're writing a piece for pipa and classical kamar trio?
Yeah. You see, we're talking earlier about the making the impossible possible, or in other words, thriving with obstacles, using obstacles or seeing obstacles rather as a challenge than as a, you know, a fending off. And Yang Qing is a Chinese pipa player, one of the foremost pipa virtuosos. We played together for several concerts, playing mostly improvised music, but also some Chinese traditional music. She arranged for various settings, also with Pago Libre. However, Yang Qing then asked me if I'd be interested to write a piece for pipa, but not for solo pipa, but for pipa and three classical guitars. I used what I found to be, you know, the differences of the sound and the approach and the technique to play the pipa, and try to first establish, especially in the first movement, two really very different worlds. You could say east, west. Mm. You could also say male, female, and so on. You know, there are many, many ways to yin-yang, the two words of yin-yang. But then what was interesting is that in the second movement, and especially in the third movement, there are lots of guitar techniques that I apply to the people. And again, first Yao Jing would very often say, oh, this is impossible, you know, I can't do that on the people. So she was trying to really watch carefully what the guitar players were doing, and after a while she applied some guitar, classical guitar, Western guitar techniques on the people.
This podcast was brought to you by Contemporary Music Centre Ireland. For more information, audio or video, go to www.cnc.ie or check out our MySpace page. That's myspace.com/CNC Ireland.